Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When research first started to nail down, confirm the impact of social networks on our lives, the findings in their specificity were startling. A bolt from the blue, decisions we thought we were making on our own suddenly confirmed as attached to huge networks of others. Now, social networks are driving revolution in the Arab world, and the social network is up in Hollywood lights for an Oscar, maybe more. This hour on Point, how our social networks shape us and the world. You can join the conversation. Do you sense how deeply our social networks shape the contours of our lives? Are you a tool, a product of your network, of your Facebook friends? And by the way, if you're not already, we'd like you to become part of On Point's quite robust social network. Follow us on Twitter or become a fan on Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will hear from New Zealand's Prime Minister John Key speaking quite movingly to his countrymen and women after the devastating earthquake that hit Christchurch yesterday. But first, joining me now are the co-authors of the book, Connected: How Your Friends, Friends, Friends Affect Everything You Feel, Think, and Do. With me in the studio is Nicholas Christakis, professor at Harvard University in the Departments of Healthcare Policy, Sociology, and Medicine. Nicholas, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from San Diego, California, is James Fowler, professor at the University of California, San Diego. Their book, Connected, is just out in paperback. James Fowler, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Can we define terms a little bit right off the bat? Because Facebook has come along since you guys began doing your research on this and just swamped the notion of social networking. It has quite a specific, explicit, maybe narrow meaning there. We'll get to that. It's hardly irrelevant as what's going on in the streets of Egypt and Tunisia and now maybe Libya with Twitter and the web and networks online feeding into vast political change. But when you and James talk about social networks and how they influence our lives, Nicholas Christakis, what are you looking at?
So what we're interested in and have been interested in, James and I, for a number of years now, is this very weird observation that each of us forms friendships, has relatives, has coworkers, has these little pairwise ties, these dyadic ties. And we humans have been doing this for hundreds of thousands of years, ever since we emerged onto the African savanna.
I'm sorry, but dyadic ties?
Dyadic, yeah. One on one. So they're little dyads of people.
Okay, but when you put them all together, they turn into, you've got illustrations in here that look like, I don't know, you know, nerve networks.
That's exactly right. Networks. And so the question is, why do we do that? Why do we humans form these ornate structures? We assemble it like ants in a colony. We make these elaborate, detailed structures, each of us making our own little decisions about
me
who to...
And you and your parents, you and your friends and your cousins, and on and on and
on.
Goes.
And on and on and on and on. And it forms these elaborate structures. And then we proceed to live our lives embedded in these structures. And our claim, James and I, is that this fact that we do this and this embeddedness in these networks results in us being influenced and having influence upon many other people who we might not be aware of and previously didn't appreciate.
James, let me give this sort of rudimentary American pushback to that. No way, Jose. We are rugged individualists. Back off with your network idea. What do you say to that, James?
Well, I'm sorry, but the evidence speaks otherwise. So we've looked at a variety of things. The first paper that really got a lot of attention was our paper on obesity. And there we found that if your friend becomes obese, it increases the likelihood that you'll become obese by about 57%. And this extends out to 3 degrees of separation. And what I mean by that is if your friend's friend becomes obese, it increases your risk. And if your friend's friend's friend becomes obese, it increases your risk as well, because these behaviors can spread in the network from person to person to person.
Let's stop right there, because now, if my friend becomes obese, maybe I'm influenced. Maybe I eat pizza with him or her, I think they look okay, so I look okay if I'm the same weight. But my friend's friend's friend, James, how does that work? Why does that matter?
Well, we have this great data now from the Framingham Heart Study where we have a full network where we can look exactly and see what happens to you, not only with respect to your own behaviors, but with respect to the behaviors of people who are around you. And what we're able to do is follow this network for a very long period of time. This network was studied for 32 years. And so we can actually, when we're trying to decide how much influence one person has on another, we can model how similar you were at the point you became friends with somebody. And after we control for that, then we're able to control for other possible causes of two people exhibiting the same characteristics.
Framingham Heart Study followed thousands of people, a set of people in Framingham, Massachusetts for decades, checking in again and again and again.
What I was going to chime in and say was that actually what we were able to show is that there's a kind of social contagion. And people are familiar with the idea that, like, if their friend has a germ right now, that germ is winding its way towards them, even though they don't themselves have it just yet. They're not sick, but they can see that their friend's friend will make their friend's friend sick, and then their friend sick, and ultimately will reach them.
But you're not talking about getting sick here. You're talking about, our ideas, our emotions, our health, our relationships, our behavior, our politics, our weight, our lifespan.
Correct.
You're saying all those things which we might think we are carving out for ourselves, we're in effect carving out or living out as part of a larger organism, a network.
That's exactly right. Now, we're not saying that we completely eliminate the individual and the individual is unimportant, but we're saying that all this embeddedness in this superorganism that we humans assemble and we form are participating in this larger entity actually affects our lives very materially. And what's interesting is that it can affect us in a way we don't even realize. So, for instance, just like your friend's friend can be infected with something, let's say a germ, but also ideas or behaviors, it could affect you via affecting these other people around you, but those other people might not show the same thing. They could be carriers and not even show the same symptoms, as it were.
And yet they pass it on to me somehow?
Yes, they do. That's right.
How do you pass an idea on to me, James Fowler, without articulating it?
Right. So I want to emphasize, you're totally right that we've studied a wide range of behaviors, but I'll go back to the obesity example because that's the one that I think most people know about. And so if you see that your friend has gained weight, it might make you feel more accepting of having more weight yourself.
Sure.
Or it might change your behaviors, or it might change your attitudes towards people with a given weight. And so if your friend puts on 5 pounds, all of a sudden now you put less pressure on your other friends to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
So you might not make a change in your own behavior. You might eat as much, you might exercise as much, but because you're not trying to influence other people to achieve this norm, you're a carrier where your behavior doesn't change, but your friend's behavior changes, another friend's behavior changes, and those two people are linked by 2 degrees of separation.
So I'm part of a super organism. I rattled some off, Nicholas, but give us a sense of the range of human attributes or categories of behavior or health state that you find are affected by these network effects?
So we've looked at a bunch of things. We've looked, of course, at things like weight gain. We've looked at smoking behavior and other health-related behavior, drinking behavior. We've also looked at emotional states. We and others, I should say, have looked at emotional states, happiness, depression, loneliness, the fact that emotions are contagious and can spread through networks. We've looked at voting behavior, political expression. We've looked at economic behavior, sexual practices, a broad range of phenomena that are deeply important to human beings. And what's interesting to us is that many of these things, people are not surprised oftentimes to hear that they're influenced in their choice of music or fashions, for example, by others. But what we've been looking at is a set of behaviors and experiences and ideas that are often counterintuitive. So people think, I choose for myself who to vote for, or I pick my own body size. And to some extent they do, but they are also deeply affected not only by the people to whom they're directly connected, but even by strangers to them, their friends' friends and their friends' friends' friends, for instance.
James, part of this seems to me to be something that we've known in our bones, for eons. Look at sacred texts, look at ancient history. People recognize themselves, let's say, as tribes, if you want to go back. And within the tribe, there are certain things that they tend to do or think or wear or... What did you find that's really new to human understanding it, that's not already intuitively understood?
Well, one of the things that we're finding is this really strong characteristic of networks for these effects that we experience to spread to 3 degrees of separation and no further. And so in all of these studies, we've looked at a variety of different behaviors, both in observational studies and in experimental studies. We find that if you do something, it's going to affect your friend, which will in turn affect their friend, which will in turn affect their friend. But the effect doesn't seem to go much further than that. And one of the things that we've looked to in terms of trying to understand why this occurs is this anthropological literature that suggests that natural human group sizes are about 150. This is work by Robin Dunbar. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look to see how many people the number of friends that they have or the number of close contacts they have, they usually say they have about five or six close friends and relatives.
Yeah.
Well, five or six times five or six times five or six is about 150. That's 3 degrees. And so the course of human history and human evolution, if you were able to influence people to 4 degrees or 5 degrees, it wouldn't have done you any good because you lived in groups that were smaller than that. And so we think evolution might actually be playing a role in the extent to which we can influence other people in our local small groups to do the same kinds of things and be the same kinds of people.
Interesting. So we're kind of running around these overlapping squads of 150 people, but now we've got Facebook with, a billion is a mark they passed not so long ago, Nicholas. Does online social networking magnify this, or is it always 3 degrees of influence no matter how many zillion people you're connected to online?
What we think that these new forms of online social networks do or offer is not much in some ways. So we describe them as the same but different. They're the same in that they feed or nourish or sustain a very fundamental human tendency to be connected to other people, to influence them and be influenced by them. And they're different in some ways, for instance, the scale that you described, and in other ways as well. But what I'd like to emphasize is that these technologies don't fundamentally change our humanity. So, for example, you might have 1,000 Facebook friends, but in fact, only a tiny fraction of them are your real friends. And in fact, one of the things that I find almost weird is that Facebook has co-opted this very old and important word in our language, friend, and applied it to a category of people who are just acquaintances.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about social networks and our lives, how the array of people around us make us, say my guests, who we are in very large part. Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler join me from here in the studio and in San Diego, California. Their book is Connected, How Your Friends, Friends, Friends Affect Everything You Feel, Think, and Do. On Sunday at the Academy Awards, right up there among them will be the very thing, the social network nominated for 8 Oscars. Mark Zuckerberg, in this little clip played by Jesse Eisenberg, lays out in the movie his vision for Facebook.
People want to go on the internet and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that friends, pictures, profiles, whatever you can visit, browse around. Maybe it's someone you just met at a party. But I'm not talking about a dating site. I'm talking about taking the entire social experience of college and putting it online.
Of college, and then maybe the whole world. Here's the real Mark Zuckerberg at the All Things Digital Conference outside of L.A. in June, reflecting on the path that led him and Facebook from the dorm room to a multi-billion-dollar company and this very networked world we now live in.
What we wanted to do and what we wanted to spend, you know, a big part of our lives doing was just continuing to push and kind of build products that help people share information,
right.
Build products that help people stay connected. And that's really what we're spending our time doing.
Are we now products of the social network created online, or is it really deeper and older than that? Let's get a call or two in here right away. Nashville, Tennessee, Cameron's calling. Hi, Cameron. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. It's a great topic. I'm from Middle East. I would like to talk mostly about how Facebook impacts or reconnect me to my family. Right now, at this moment when I'm speaking, there's a huge protest going on in Soleimani, North Iraq, which we don't see a lot of coverage in Fox News or CNN, like in Libya, really. And to me, my sister, my brother's involved. They send me, they put the church, Facebook, they have laptop in there. It's really my primary sources to get news. Second, what I want to talk about is, you know, before when somebody was died, was just leaving a will, but now you can have, like, personal data. When you leave this world, everything is going to stay on the internet. It's like a personal. The third one, I was really able to reconnect it with my classmates when I was at university. Most of my friends are in Europe, everywhere. They find me on Facebook. We see the old pictures, share. It looks like memory. For me, I will say I'm not a product for Facebook. I'm a producer, you know. In 2 days, it looks like everything is changing. You know, you can be a journalist. not go to a university, just have a laptop, a cell phone, you can just transfer the news and you can connect it just like in a second through the Facebook.
Cameron, I'm going to stop you there. Your line is a little rough, but you've put a lot on the table, and it's really great. I appreciate your call from Nashville. James Nicholas, all right, here's Cameron. He says, you know, he's all plugged in right now as we speak to big stuff going on in northern Iraq that who would have known, but he knows. And he feels entirely plugged into that. And he's also looking, you know, at his role in this online realm and saying, I'm not a product, I'm a producer. Maybe that's a good place to pause here and think about these distinctions between social network as we understood it, maybe when you guys started some of your research, and now when Facebook and its ilk have sort of taken over that term. I mean, they are and are not the same thing. Nicholas.
Yeah, exactly. So just think back for a moment to the invention of the telephone. The invention of the telephone was an amazing thing 100 years ago, and it provided the ability for people to interact and communicate with each other, but it didn't fundamentally change human interaction. It didn't change how many friends you had. It didn't change your interest in influencing your friends or the way your friends influenced you. And it didn't mean that a stranger calling you would somehow magically be able to transform your life or make you do things you wouldn't otherwise do.
But the web is different from the telephone. The web is a network. The telephone was, what was the word you used? Dyadic.
Yeah, dyadic. Like a dyadic communication.
Except for that old party line. But I mean, now we have a real network.
No, but I would argue, we would argue, and we do, that actually what these online networks do is they make visual, certainly, these types of structures we humans have always made, but they are a kind of a medium of communication. And in Maine, the main thing that they do, just like the caller just said, is he's not a product, he's a producer, he's an active participant in this thing. If I contacted him on Facebook, he would probably ignore me, wouldn't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. But if his real friends use this technology to interact with him, then it affects him. And so that's part of what's going on. On the other hand, it is also true that the things are different. So the speed, the scale, the specificity of the interaction, these things have changed and are in part a reflection of the new technology.
James Fowler, our caller Cameron is looking at what's going on in the Middle East. We know a lot of that in Tunisia and then in Egypt got at the very least magnified through these through this network technology. You talk in the book Connected about emotional stampedes. Surely there's some element of that going on in the political movements we're seeing right now in the Middle East. This may not be shaping people's weight, but it's shaping their politics. It's putting feet in the streets.
There's no doubt that the real-world social networks are helping to spread these revolutions from one country to another. And you have personal points of contact between the countries. And those points of contact, it depends on what era you're in, what technology they'll use to express themselves. And so when you look back at the Russian Revolution, for example, the one where they overthrew the communist state, the fax machine was incredibly important. You had this network of fax machines that allowed them to communicate in a way they weren't able to communicate in order to organize protests. And so today now we have a lot more activity on Facebook and Twitter, and that's the medium through which people are really excited about sharing ideas and sharing new information. Who knows what it'll be 50 years from now?
Here's a web comment, speaking of networked in, from Pickle Dog. Love these names. Great topic, Pickle Dog says. He says, I think you're missing a bigger point that in today's world, time and space have flattened so that I'm in daily contact with people that live in other places in the world and who were connected to me in high school but today are not. If all that is brought back, Nicholas, you say 3 degrees of separation, but there's so many degrees that can come into play. Does it not at least magnify the effects that you ferreted out of this research in your original publication?
It can do, but if you think about it, before the invention of the telephone, people wrote letters to each other, and so the invention of the phone accelerates the speed with which you can talk to each other. So the caller is right that it does collapse time and space, but it doesn't fundamentally change the fact that if I again contacted him, he would not respond to me because I'm a stranger to him. So what really matters is this fundamental human tendency to pay attention to people we care about, to have things at stake and use the technology to communicate with each other when things really matter.
Can I just jump in here?
Yes.
We've also, you know, we've studied behaviors online, and one of the things that we find consistently in these Facebook networks is that if you look to see whether or not my behavior is correlated with my Facebook friend, it's not, because there's too many of them. People will have 500, 600 friends these days on Facebook, but those are people who are just acquaintances, many of them. And what we have to do is we have to restrict our analysis to just the people who have uploaded and tagged photos of one another. We call these photo friends. And when we look there to see whether or not behavior is correlated in music taste, in movie taste, in book taste, in how heavy you are, whether or not you're smiling in a profile picture, we've looked at a lot of different things. There you do find this connection, but it's between people who already show evidence of having a real-world relationship. And so the real-world relationship, the friends and family that we've always had, those are going to be the things at the core of these new online social media.
Maybe there's two or more different depths of impact here. I mean, the superorganism of the networked human, he or she may think they're carving themselves from the raw stuff of life, but you're describing them as part of this sort of a bigger thing. It reminded me of the notion of Gaia, of the whole planet being kind of alive. You're looking at all humanity and saying it ends up being kind of one great big life form or organism. Surely at least its behavior then is affected by the tighter connections that come in this bigger network.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all live in these local environments, these local areas of the network where we're aware of and interacting with and being affected by the actions and thoughts and behaviors of these people that are, let's say, within 2 or 3 degrees of separation of us. But they, in turn, are further connected. And in fact, we do form some kind of global network. Now, James and I are not saying, nor have we said, that if I take an action, it can change the whole world. In fact, quite the contrary. Earlier, we were talking about how our effect and our influence decays in the network. So just because we're connected to everyone else on the planet by an average of 6 degrees of separation does not mean we can affect, like today, I can do something and affect everyone else. Number one, because the effect decays as it moves through the network. And number two, because lots of other people are taking actions. So everyone in this whole global world is doing things all the time. Think of it as like pebbles being dropped on the surface of a pond. If you drop one rock on the surface, mm-hmm. you can see the ripples. But if you throw a handful of rocks, you get a choppy surface, lots of conflict and things going back and forth. That's part of the reason that a single person doing something can't affect everybody, but a single person doing something does create waves that spread out and can affect the people nearby.
And once in a while, a fruit peddler in Tunisia has an unbelievable effect. Rob in Stoughton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Rob. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually calling to interject in regards to some of the research you're talking about with obesity. I actually started to use Facebook to monitor my progress and let everyone know how I was doing with my weight loss because it was helping me. And I soon found out that friends and friends of friends started to post that they were starting to watch how they were eating and they were starting to lose weight themselves. And I noticed that, you know, it kind of like sparked something there.
So you're feeling a kind of ripple of support then. I mean, it seems like a similar dynamic, if not the same thing, Nicholas.
That's exactly right. But they're using the Facebook technology to stay in touch with each other, and you're getting just these kind of ripples. In fact, I would suspect that when the caller loses some weight and it affects his friends, then it could affect their friends. He might wind up fostering weight loss dozens, maybe hundreds of pounds in the community of people around him. Many people he's never even met might be benefiting, as it were, from his actions.
James, take us back to the kind of old original here, even pre-Facebook, what you're saying, and some of the nuances of how this ripples through. I mean, you're looking at the very lifespans of people being related to the networks in which they live. Now, is that just sharing habits of exercise and diet or something else going on there? Is it very clear that I can live longer if I hang out with other people on a long-lived path?
Well, one of the sort of big differences that we found across a number of our studies is that behaviors don't tend to spread the same way as emotions. And so just for example, if your next-door neighbor became obese and you're a member of the Framingham Heart Study, it had no impact on you whatsoever. Whether or not they gained weight, lost weight, it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
But if they became happy, because there were a number of times when people in that study reported how happy they were, if they became happy, your next-door neighbor, then and that actually did have an effect on you for about a year. And so what we're finding is that these emotions are more likely to spread through weak ties. And so especially when you're talking about, you know, the spread of these demonstrations, the emotions are running high. This emotional contagion, it really can spread between people who have more tenuous links. And so if you have a technology that brings people more in touch with people who with whom they have more tenuous links, like Facebook, where we'll have hundreds of contacts, then you can imagine that the online social networks are actually going to be doing something that's a little bit new, because it's much easier to spread your happy feelings to 600 people now than it used to be.
Can I shape this, Nicholas? Okay, let's say I buy. I can't just carve my own identity single-handedly out of the raw rock of existence. It's part of a network. But can I shape my life by then choosing my network? Sort of, you know, hanging out with people who look, you know, who sort of model what I hope to be, and therefore I become that?
It's complicated because you can do a variety of things. You could, for example, pick how many people you interact with. You could pick what kind of people you interact with. You could pick whether or not you want to help collaborate with them to improve your life or their lives. So there are a lot of choices that individuals make. And what we find is that some fraction of that is not modifiable. I mean, people are born, let's say, with a certain tendency. Some people are shy. Some are gregarious. Some people like few friends. Some like many friends. And we also find that it can be complicated. For example, let's say your friend is gaining weight and you think, oh, my goodness, if I cut the ties to my friend, that'll stop that influence. Well, it might to some extent. But on the other hand, you've now lost a friend. So any benefits you might have acquired from interrupting that contagion or that influence is now counteracted by the costs you pay in losing a friendship. So these effects, these choices are complicated. It's not obvious. Now, if your friends are all armed robbers.
Hard to work the system.
Yes, it is hard to work the system. But if your friends are armed robbers, I would suggest, you know, cut the ties to them. That would be a sensible choice.
On the other hand, I mean, this is another argument for why it's worth putting – there's so many reasons – but why it's worth putting the work into a political life. If we're shaped by those around us, I mean, the sort of nature of our society, of the social networks we develop within it are going to – there's hardly a clearer argument that it's going to come right back to roost on your own personal doorstep. So care. So be engaged in helping mold it.
That's exactly right. It's exactly right. And in fact, one of the arguments.
1 degree.
Yeah, 1 degree. And in fact,
that's right.
One of the arguments we make in the book is that the reason human beings form social networks is that the benefits of a connected life outweigh the costs. In fact, that's why we do it. We assemble these elaborate structures because we create a kind of commons, a kind of collective good that winds up benefiting us. We pay some prices, so violence can spread through networks, germs can spread through networks, but we also get huge benefits.
Let's get a call from Salt Lake City, Utah. Miriam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually on Facebook right now.
Of course. It's 2011.
I'm sorry?
Of course. Everybody is. I'm sorry. Go on, Mary.
We're not writing about the show. I started on Facebook a couple of years ago, kind of after one of my kids sent me on. But since then, I've really used it a lot, especially with politics, issues that people with disabilities, and very personal emotional things. I have well over 600 friends, most of which I would consider acquaintances, and I have accepted friendships from strangers.
Miriam, do you think it is shaping you or reshaping you, or is it simply giving you a larger field in which to, I don't know, find opinions and share outlooks, or is it shaping you?
I think it has shaped me. I know I've shaped other people. But the main thing, it does give a place to express how I feel, what I think, why, where it comes from. I'm good friends with a number of people who believe completely opposite as I do, but are willing to discuss.
I love it. Miriam, thank you very much for your call. Nicholas, is it possible that in its sort of physical or digital manifestation of networks, that the whole meme of networks is becoming more familiar to us because of Facebook, et cetera? Therefore, we're more in tune with the kind of notions that you're sharing with us here.
Yes, I think that is one of the things that the internet age has done over the last 10 years is it's made us more aware of our embeddedness in these large, elaborate structures. It's made these connections visible. So while we might have known in the past that we were connected to others and even to strangers via a set of connections, now we can see those and we're aware of them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about social networks and our lives, how the array of people around us make us who we are, with Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, co-authors of the book Connected. It's just out in paperback, but it just seems to become more relevant as we move into the era of social networkness online. It's brought the whole idea very front and center. Of course, you're hearing their research goes beyond that Facebook connection. I want to be sure, because the time goes by so quickly, Nicholas, what's the most important thing you want us to understand from the fact of social networks' impact that you and James are describing here. What's the most important takeaway for us? If we know and accept it, then what?
Okay, I would say that there are two facts, if I might. One is the point we made a bit earlier, which is that the benefits of a connected life outweigh the costs, that fundamentally our embeddedness in social networks is a force for good in our species. And we have a set of ideas and arguments as to why that is. The second big idea I think that is important for people to realize is that networks tend to magnify whatever they are seeded with. So they're agnostic. Networks don't on their own give rise to phenomena. Something else has to come into the system and perturb it, like a fruit seller, you know, setting himself mm-hmm. on fire. Mm-hmm. When that happens outside, then the human interactions can take over and result in a cascade of revolutions. But the crucial thing to realize is that if you have like a forest and you want to set up a conflagration, mm-hmm. it's not enough to just throw a match into the forest. You also have to have a dry forest. The circumstances have to be convivial for this like forest fire to take off, for this mm-hmm. Holocaust to arise. Mm-hmm. So it takes both. It takes both some kind of a prepared environment, a kind of set of human actions, a network on a vast scale that makes it possible for something to happen, and a kind of, you know, a match being thrown into it. And then the network can take over and magnify what it's been seeded with.
James Fowler, is it possible in our technologically networked world now that you write about emotional stampedes here? Is it possible, I think some people may intuitively feel this, that we're being hit with more of those these days, that the networking has become more dense or compressed, you know, that the hits on us are more frequent and common? We heard the NPR story just this morning saying that extremist groups are on the rise. We've all felt polarization being on the rise. You know, are we being pinged more often and pushed more often by our networks now?
Yes, and one of the things that I think is, you know, we talk about how online networks are the same but different. One of the crucial ways in which they're different is it is now much easier for you to make friends with people who are like you. And so we have a lovely picture in the book of the network that was done by Lada Adamek of the political blogosphere. Mm. And what it shows is it shows all the red nodes are the conservative blogs and all the blue nodes are the liberal blogs. And then it shows who links to whom in their stories. Mm-hmm. And there's hardly any links between those two groups. All the links are between the liberals and between the conservatives, and very few go across the two groups. And so one of the things that we need, I think,
it's like a Venn diagram, but it's two different sort of huge splotches, barely touching one another.
Huge splotches of red and blue. That's right. And so, you know, one of the theories about democratic discourse is that if you just increase the ability to communicate, then, you know, information will naturally flow and you'll get this dialogue between people with different interests. And one of the problems with online social networks is you can now become friends with people who are just like you. And we do have this tendency to seek out people who have similar interests to us. So we had the caller earlier who said that he was staying in touch with people in northern Iraq. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, that's a great thing because he can now stay in touch with friends and family members that he wouldn't be able to stay in touch with because we're a very mobile society. But on the other hand, now we have to worry just a little bit about how our interests are going to be diverge as a result of being able to do this online.
It makes me wonder if the web becomes like a drug does it produce a perversion of our evolutionary path here? If it ramps it up, maybe this is like alcohol or heroin to our impulse to be network influenced.
It could, but what it does is what James is describing is the way it could make it easier for us to create our own private echo chambers. So on the one hand, it facilitates, like you would think, this ability to reach out and touch anyone. But in fact, what it also facilitates is the fact that we could make our own private echo chamber and just interact with people like us, which sometimes can lead to like this tremendous collective movement, but on the other times can lead to people only being aware of very narrow types of information.
It also sounds like an opportunity for manipulation. David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, gentlemen. Hi. I'm calling because for the last couple of months I've been transcribing some letters that were written by a middle-aged man in the years 1849, 50, 51, thereabouts. And he left New York to go to the gold rush in California. He was on a boat for 200 days, traveling south, going around the Horn of South America.
Love it.
And then when he was over there, he wrote letters as well from San Francisco and Sacramento. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, he only got letters out every 2 to 3 months. And in one that I was working on recently, he was writing in May, and he had just recently received from his sweetheart, who often gave him news about friends and family, letters from August, October, and January of the previous year and month.
Right.
And it, this conversation you've had today has just made me wonder and compare the character of people back then, for example, their ability to make individual decisions, to maybe make new networks of friends out there, say, in this case, in California. This is a very accomplished man. He accomplished a lot of things in his life. So I was wondering if you folks could maybe comment on that in the day when on, you know, Facebook, it seems like people have to share every little detail and nitty-gritty in order to move forward.
That is interesting. Nicholas, could we be quivering slaves to our network now that they're plugged in every 3 seconds to our ear compared to, you know, these letters, the 200 days around the horn, you're your own guy, or do we adapt to whatever we're surrounded by? Maybe he joined the social network of the sailors for that time, and they were shaping him.
Yeah, I mean, I think we talk in a little bit of a book, we talk about something analogous, which is the correspondence between John Quincy Adams and his wife Abigail Adams. We talk a little bit about that correspondence and, you know, the kind of rhythm of that, taking months to cross the Atlantic back and forth the letters, just like the caller just described. But like the other caller said earlier, what's happened is these technologies have compressed time and space. So this is what we mean by it's different. When we talk about the internet and Facebook and Twitter being the same but different, this is different. But it's the same in the sense that you're still seeking out and interacting with your loved ones and people you care about, and you're still affected by them. So that's the same. But what is different, as the caller points out, is the speed, and this public display as well can also be quite different.
Let me get Renee on from Shackelford, Virginia. Renee, thanks for calling. Hi, Renee, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What can you tell us, Renee?
Okay, well, I have become very involved with Facebook in the past couple of years. Last year, my husband and I started raising chickens, and so I started, you know, reaching out on Facebook for other people who raise chickens and who love chickens as pets.
Okay.
And
this is a
real-life
Farmville.
Yeah, okay. Go on, Renee, we're listening.
Yeah, and well, as a result, you know, I've got like, you know, 600 and some friends now, right?
Chickens
some of these people, we have differing views on, let's say, politics, but because we have this one thread that we love about each other, we have learned to become tolerant and to actually listen to each other's differing views.
I think this is actually really terrific.
Right.
And it goes back to here's your old as the hills trend. But in this case, who knows if Renee would have found 600 people interested in raising chickens, and through raising chickens, they're suddenly talking about everything and maybe being influenced.
Okay, so this is one of the ways we describe as the internet is different. Okay, there are four ways we talk about. There's enormity, communality, specificity, and wikiality or virtuality. So what we mean, she's describing one of the four examples, which is specificity, the ability that these tools provide to find specific other individuals. If you were looking for people who raise chickens as pets, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it'd be very hard to find such people. There were technologies, but it was hard. Now in seconds, you can click, and if you want to find an Estonian veterinarian, bang, you find him within minutes, okay?
But then also absorbing his attitudes?
Well, then it can lead to now having this technology, having facilitated this connection, then can provide this fertile substrate for the old-fashioned types of influence and connection that we humans have always been interested in. There are other ways, incidentally. Yeah, I'm sorry, James, you go.
And let me just jump in and say, you know, the evidence also suggests that the more time you spend online in these social networks, the more time you're going to organize real-world social activity. So Barry Wellman has done some great work showing that there's actually a causal relationship between the ability to stay in touch with people and to form relationships online, and then the number of coffees you have in the real world, the number of times you meet people in the real world, the number of real-world friends that you have.
Is it diminishing our individuality or somehow enhancing it, because human individuality is all about the expression of network connectedness?
No, there's no way it's diminishing it. And this is, I always say this, that you have to realize your network power. You know, we are showing all of these things that can affect you, but in turn, you can affect them. And, you know, what a wonderful world. Now that we really see how we're embedded in these networks, I don't just affect the 5 or 6 close people that I'm connected to. I potentially affect the people they're connected to and the people that they're connected to. Suddenly now, when I do something good, it's not only good for me, it's not only good for those 5 or 6 people, it's good for dozens, potentially hundreds of other people in the world.
Here's a comment from Loring, who, among other things, asks, he says, this, or she says, this sounds like dependent origination that Buddhists talk about, that I, quote-unquote, don't exist, that Personality is the interaction of personal psychological conditioning along with cultural conditioning. Are we on the same page, Nicholas? Loring asks.
We get those kinds of questions a lot, and in some sense, yes, I would say these types of theological insights, these types of theological concerns have always sought to explain the tension between the individual and the collective. And this notion of kind of animating spirits, like, you know, how do crowds suddenly come to think alike? And so Buddhism and other religions have all engaged this tension. And many people, when they read the kind of scientific stuff that James and I are writing about, recognize in it kind of very ancient ideas about the role of the individual in the group.
Watch out. Help us watch out for a second here. What about the potential for manipulation here then? If we're in the era where technology allows social networks to be created and worked, what do we need to watch out for? Should we be afraid, very afraid?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know.
Not afraid.
Well, like we said earlier, I mean, I think networks magnify whatever they're seeded with. So they will magnify fascism. They will magnify false beliefs, rumors, and gossip. They will magnify deadly germs. You know, if you have a group of people that isn't interacting with each other, you infect one of them, you don't get an epidemic. But if they interact with
piece.
Yeah, I'm sorry, James. You go, James.
No, I heard a piece on NPR this morning about a woman in Bahrain who's one of the demonstrators who clearly is demonstrating because the people's demonstrations have spread. And she's looking at what's going on in Libya. And she made a very prescient comment. She said, I hope that the government repression doesn't spread. And so both of those kinds of things can spread. The network can be a vehicle for either one of those things.
Does network awareness matter? Does it matter if we're more aware of what's going on? Does that change the way it may affect us? Does it make us more, wholly engaged in life or with ourselves if we're the product of networks? Or was it just as well, you know, 200 years ago when people just lived and did what they did?
I mean, James, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, no, I think an awareness of networks actually changes us. It is definitely a game changer. For me, when we started doing the scientific research, I completely changed my own behavior. When we wrote the obesity paper, I actually lost 5 pounds.
Thank you, James. That helped me a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure it did.
Me too now. Thank you.
When we wrote the happiness paper, I suddenly took more care in putting myself in a good mood when I came home at the end of the day. And it's because I realized that I had network power, that I wasn't just going to be affecting people I see. I'm going to be affecting people I don't see. And when you realize that, it gives me goosebumps just talking about it. When you realize that you really do have an effect on dozens, in some cases, hundreds of other people, even in your daily activities, it raises the stakes. And I think it makes the power of positive action just that much more important.
Well, we are all a super organism now, as you'd have it. And I guess maybe you're right. Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, authors of Connected, How Your Friends, Friends, Friends Affect Everything You Feel, Think, and Do. It's just out in paperback, maybe more relevant than ever right now. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nicholas, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And James Fowler at the University of California, San Diego. James, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we turn to New Zealand and the devastating earthquake that hit that country yesterday and a message of hope. This is On Point. A 6.3 magnitude earthquake hit New Zealand's second largest city, Christchurch, at lunchtime yesterday. 75 are confirmed dead. Hundreds more are missing. The images of collapse and confusion from the city have been shocking. Prime Minister John Key held a press conference in New Zealand today to speak to the devastation and to rally his country. We wanted to share an excerpt with you.
In the weeks ahead, our journey will take us to new obstacles and new challenges. We have a city to rebuild. We have people's livelihoods to restore. We have a community's confidence to inspire. We will rise to these challenges. We will rebuild the city resolutely and with the conviction that this is what it is to be a Cantabrian, what it is to be a New Zealander. We are a country of pioneers. Whether we came by waka, sailboat or aeroplane, we came with the conviction that we could build a new life in this country. That great pioneering spirit will come to the fore in Christchurch over the coming months and years. Though lives lost will never be replaced, though your city will never look the same again, you will rebuild your city, you will rebuild your lives, you will overcome. We've seen many cities in the world come back from disaster on this scale, and Christchurch will be no exception. I know that all New Zealanders stand ready to help. Right now, we can help by rallying around those who are grieving, supporting those whose livelihoods are in peril. My message to all Kiwis who want to help is this: act on that desire. No act of kindness is too small. Right now, you can help by offering support to friends and families who are hurting. Offer them a bed or a roof over their head if that is what they need. Make your donations to help those who have been hit hardest. And as infrastructure recovers, your visits to Christchurch will be welcome. Above all, throughout this journey, offer those affected your love. Know that your humanity is more powerful than any act of nature. As we look to the future, New Zealanders should know that the government is going to do everything we can to support the recovery and rebuilding of Christchurch. We are a resilient nature. We will not bow down to this challenge.
You will overcome. Overcome, we hear there. We are all indeed networked. New Zealand Prime Minister John Key speaking today about the devastating earthquake in Christchurch, New Zealand. You can read a full transcript of his remarks at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.